here in Paris. It's a public talk. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gattis, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Nermeen Sheikh, Sam Malkoff, Robbie Karen, Steve Martinez, Hani Massoud, Juan Carlos Davila, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, David Crude, Ariel Boone, and to Dennis Moynihan and John Hamilton. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Amy Goodman.
The time is 7:59. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up, Paul Rowland, host Wednesday Talk Radio. His guest is Robert Hunziker, who writes about climate change, Fukushima, and political issues.
Thank you to all of our new and renewing members during our winter membership drive. That makes KBOO one of the best community radio stations in the country. We fell a few thousand short of our goal of 55,000, so if you didn't have a chance to give, it's never too late. Remember, for the month of December, if you become a new member or if you increase your giving over last year, your gift will be matched by a number of local businesses and individual donors. Donate now at kboo.fm/give. Thank you once again for being the best supporters a station could ever ask for.
I'm Sonny Blechinger, KBOO's Artist in Residence for 2015. Hope you'll join us at the Clinton Street Theater December 10th, Thursday night at 7 p.m. for the broadcast of my radio play, The Pool. It's about four swimmers who happen to use the same pool at the same time every week. It'll be broadcast with new video by local filmmaker Lincoln Baron Holmes and hosted by the comedians from American Comedy, Paul Schlesinger and Jason Traeger. Following the radio play will be a screening of the 1968 film The Swimmer, starring Burt Lancaster. Again, that's Thursday night, December 10th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Charles Adams Family and Friends, an art show of 52 original artworks by the creator of the Adams Family and beloved New Yorker cartoonist. The show is up through December 13th at the Saruman House, 5131 Northeast 23rd Avenue in Portland. Saruman House is open Thursday and Friday from 4 to 8 p.m. and Saturdays and Sunday from noon to 4 p.m. Again, that's Charles Adams Family and Friends, an art exhibit up through December 13th at the Saruman House in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It is what it is. So no use in wishing, hoping, and wanting. And those if only, and those coulda, shoulda, and wouldas are just troubles for the head. And crying around about most anything is just a waste of tears.
It is what it is.
It is what it is. Life doesn't put anything in front of us that we can't handle. It's all in the handling. Coherent or incoherent. Clarity or chaos. Another thing. Everything that ever happens is there to make us stronger. And when we understand, our strength gets stronger. And when we don't understand, our weaknesses get stronger. It's an inevitability.
And when falling down falls down, how down can falling down,
falling down
fall?
Falls down, how down can falling down fall?
And when getting back up gets back up, how up can getting back up get back up? In the reality of being, reality waits for human recognition, to recognize the power of intelligence clearly used is a way of seeing, curing, healing spirit. It's not about whether we can or can't. It's about whether we will or we won't.
It is what it is.
It is what it is. The blamers and the blamed.
The blamers and the blamed.
Play a dangerous game.
Play a dangerous game.
Turning responsibility into another one of their casualties. Inside of ourselves. And amongst ourselves, desperating, while hidden behind the light cast by our shadows, life holds its breath, and alive wants us to live the gift we were given. It's a decision we make.
It is what it is.
It is what it is. So no use in wishing, hoping, and wanting.
And good morning. You're listening to Wednesday Talk Radio. Goodbye, John Trudell, who you just heard. He left us, as he put it, his ride showed up. So I believe his last words written down. He faced his bout with cancer with strength and grace, from what I understand. I feel very lucky to have seen him in maybe his last show ever. Came up in the last stages of cancer, came up and did a show at Hempstock here in Portland just a few months ago. And an incredibly wonderful double rainbow came out as they were playing, framed the stage in the background over the Willamette River. Quite a remarkable sight. He says, I want people to remember me as they remember me. You're going to be hearing a lot about John coming up. If you don't know, check out his music, his poetry set to music. He was a Santee Dakota activist, artist, actor, and poet. Led a life dedicated to Indigenous human rights, land and language issues, helped spark a spoken word movement that is a continuation of Native American oral traditions. He walked on yesterday at the age of 69. Known politically as one of the leaders and spokespeople for the Alcatraz occupation in 1969-70, and chairman of the American Indian Movement in the 70s. Paid a heavy price. Perhaps the greatest legacy he left, other than his music, was the leading the trail of broken treaties caravan, and they were trying to stem a attempt to terminate basically all the federal tribes. It's just something that's been kind of coming, been attempted ever since the treaties were written, and got wind that there was a serious effort to introduce new legislation to unilaterally abrogate treaties. And they actually got a lot of the documents when they occupied the Bureau of Indian Affairs and put a stop to that. So maybe that's, after all, his and his movement's greatest legacy, as the resurgence of the indigenous peoples, the Native Nations, continues
to this day. So we are here, and this is Live Talk Radio. The name of the show is Reckoning with Reality. There is no way out. And it is what it is, as John said. And we have with us a guest all the way from Los Angeles, California, by telephone, Robert Hunsaker. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning, Paul.
And we're going to be talking about a lot of, you know, heavy-duty stuff, timely stuff. You've been writing recently a lot about Fukushima, which has sort of fallen out of the press. Well, pretty much ever since it happened, it's fallen off. But you've been taking that on, telling us what's the continuing developments or and lack of addressing those developments are in that perhaps the greatest industrial catastrophe in the history of the world at this point. Your most recent piece is Tokyo 2020 in the Shadow of Godzilla. Tokyo 2020, Tokyo ready to proceed with $1.3 billion Olympic Stadium. And you also wrote an article just before that called The Looming Transnational Battlefield, talking about the continuing games of the imperial class plays as the world burns and is radiated. And sort of an interesting take on Bernie Sanders in that piece. And of course, you've been addressing the issue of climate change for months and years now, and I've interviewed you mainly about that. So what would you like to talk about in you know, the addressing the theme of reckoning with reality to start off today's show?
Well, I think, Paul, it's a great wide open question, but I think that when you reckon with reality and how does reality hit people, there have been some interesting studies done vis-a-vis the whole environmental issue, global warming issue, that kind of hit home with what you're talking about. Charles Ramsey of the University of Minnesota, for example, did wrote a book, in fact, Environmental Knowledge and Attitudes. And what he said there is that attitudes and values take a lot of time to nurture. And environmental literacy, it's not a short-term course. It's a very long-term course. So I think one of the issues when you talk about this reality is, for me personally, it took me several years to really grasp the reality of the global warming problem. You know, when you think about it, people hear 400 ppm, parts per million. And when you say, well, parts per million, that sounds kind of small. But it's not in effect on our climate. It's very large in effect on our climate. But those are the kind of things that people have to adjust into their mindset. And Rene Lertzman of the Royal Road University in the UK wrote a book, The Myth of Climate Change Apathy. And what she said, and according to her studies, people care deeply about climate change. They really do. They just don't know how to reframe their thinking to latch onto it and really understand it, and they feel lost. And it just it seems so overwhelming, and it is overwhelming. So I think what I'm talking about kind of dovetails in with what you're talking about, the title of your program today. But the other thing that I'd like to spend some time on is this whole issue about NGOs, non-governmental organizations, like environmental groups, like the Environmental Defense Fund and
World Wildlife Fund.
Yeah, World Wildlife Fund, and all of these, because here's what's interesting. We all kind of pay heed to those various organizations, and a lot of us give money to them. And Naomi Klein made a really interesting observation, and I really like her a lot. She said that big green groups do more harm than good for saving the planet. And I thought that was extremely provocative. And what she's talking about, Paul, and she's talking about something that we call MANGOs. And MANGOs are market non-governmental organizations, spelled capital M, small a, capital N, capital G, capital O, MANGOs. What they are is they're companies that they want to try and shape our notions of social responsibility, but they do it in ways that are in accordance with concerns of business. For example, Save the Children. We all know about Save the Children. And they do humanitarian work around the world. Well, they have two of their biggest sponsors are Coke and Pepsi. So when the issue of childhood obesity in the U.S. came up, they started to get involved in some kind of leadership to expose this, and eventually they canceled it and decided it was too controversial to continue. So you see the rub there. Coke and Pepsi co-sponsors. Furthermore, you look at some of these really well-known groups, Sierra Club, for example. They receive $25 million in donations every year from the gas industry. Chesapeake Energy is their biggest donor. Their partnership with Clorox for their green cleaning products, the Sierra logos used in exchange for getting a percentage of the sales. Greenpeace is in partnership with Unilever and Coke to promote Green Freeze, which is a refrigeration technology. The Nature Conservatory is in partnership with Boeing, British Petroleum, and Shell, and Monsanto, and Walmart.
Well, you know, it's interesting that, Naomi Klein, one of the first books, I don't know if it was her first book, the one that brought her to great public attention was called No Logo. And, you know, if you look at some of these major sort of initiatives on global warming, unfortunately, I don't have my notes right with me, but there's one in particular that had all these NGOs involved in it, and it was all their logos. And then, you know, you're saying, you know, there's all these NGOs that are matching up, partnering with these corporations that have their own. You could almost put, you know, the NGO's logo along with the corporate logo. You know, it seems like the lessons that, you know, the strongest lessons that people like Naomi Klein have been putting out in terms of warning against the dangers of allowing the corporate mindset to dominate how we proceed is it seems to really not be taken seriously at least at those levels that you're talking about. And it seems like it's at such a subtle level too. You know, I think what I try to warn against is how it operates at the deepest levels of our psyches in ways that we're not even necessarily aware of. Anyway, so this is Talk Radio. My guest is Robert Hunsaker from Los Angeles. He's a journalist who writes for I come across him most often in Counterpunch, but he writes in many other places. And he has, you can reach him, I believe. He gives out his email address. One of his email addresses freely. We can give that if you're interested, Robert. The number to call is 503-231-8187, where it's a kind of a wide-ranging conversation. I do want to touch on Fukushima, because that's something that we haven't, I haven't addressed recently. And I think your take on it, the Olympic Games coming up is a really important thing to look at, because that's another way that, you know, nations sort of divert attention from reality and the bread and circuses phenomenon, or the spectacle, as Guy Debord put it, is just gruesome, just truly gruesome in this case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. In fact, if you look at that situation, what we do know about Fukushima is that it's totally out of control, and they don't really know how to fix it. But when I say out of control, we're talking about the China syndrome in red flashing lights here, because what's happened is they cannot locate the corium or the molten core for plant number two. It's gone. It's missing. Well, if it's missing, the first line of defense is the containment vessel that's in to produce the ongoing impact of atom splitting. Then beyond that, there's a steel reinforced concrete containment vessel. It's the second line of defense. And whether it has burrowed through that into the ground, nobody knows. But if it has, that is a huge problem because you're going to have all kinds of radioactive isotopes that are going to be ubiquitously and erratically spreading throughout the ground and the water sources. And you don't even know how far that'll go. So we may be seeing the greatest nightmare of all time in terms of the nuclear industry. It's a major catastrophe, but yet, the Olympic Committee in 2013 said, we were assured by Prime Minister Abe that, one, they had control of their nuclear facility, of this disaster, and secondly, that they also had blocked off any spreading through the bay into the Pacific Ocean. That's what he assured the Olympic Committee of in 2013. By the way, when he did that, Nature, the editor of Nature magazine, immediately came out with an editorial that talked about the insanity, literally the insanity of a major international organization like the Olympic Committee, designating the Olympics 2 years on the right on the tail end of a totally out of control nuclear meltdown. And it is insane. But here we are, and they did it. And, of course, you have to wonder who worked where. By the way, there's been a lot of criticism over the years about, and I hate to even suggest this, but all kinds of ways of influencing people in the Olympic Committee. Let's just say that. Now, so the Olympics are scheduled. They announced here just about a month ago, Tokyo said, we're going to spend $1.3 billion on our new Olympic stadium, plus the entire cost of this thing will be about $24 billion. Meanwhile, and here's where the criticism comes into play, there are some people of stature in Japan, like the former ambassador to Switzerland, Ambassador Murata, who publicly has come out and suggested and sent letters to the Olympic Committee, he sent letters to the Prime Minister, Abe, that they cancel their Olympics. Because what's happening is if you're going to promote the Olympics between now and 2020, you're really suggesting to the world, and this gets right into the theme of what you're talking about, Paul, this reality business, you're suggesting implanting in the minds of the world that everything's okay with Fukushima. It's really okay.
Do you think there's an analogy? Do you think there's an analogy to be drawn with the 1936 Olympics here? I mean, it's kind of grim.
Well put. But not only that, Fukushima is trying to hold the soccer matches. Actually, the prefecture of Fukushima,
oh my goodness,
where this happened, wants to hold the soccer matches. So I wrote in my article, I think it's an insult to the Olympians of the world. I also think it's an insult to the hundreds of thousands of people who are going to go there when you have right on your back doorstep an out-of-control nuclear plant that nobody can fix, and they don't even know what's going on with it. So, and every time they try to fix something, it gets broken again. So that is an ongoing, and they're just not going to, it's going to take decades beyond our lifetime to control this in the final analysis. I don't know what they'll do. They're still trying to control the situation in Eastern Europe. The name of it just slips my mind as we talk.
Chernobyl?
Chernobyl, right. They're still working to put some kind of a sarcophagus, a huge metallic dome, the biggest in the world, thickest in the world. They're trying to build it and move it into that. So they're still, 25, 30 years later, working on controlling that. This is bigger. And what's happened is, of course, and this is one of the crimes of our lifetime, is that on the heels of the Fukushima disaster, the Abe government passed a new secrecy law. And that secrecy law is a wide open tablet for any politician in his administration, in their parliament, to state that somebody has broken the secrecy law, and they can go to prison for 10 years, and that applies to journalists. And this is really going back to the witch hunt days, McCarthy era, in the 1950s, the United States. That's where they've retreated to in Japan.
Well, you know, what you started out by saying in terms of, you know, dealing or not dealing with the climate crisis, you know, obviously we have got multiple crises. The capitalist system continues to teeter, as you talk about in your piece, the looming transnational battlefield, and seems to be on the verge of yet another collapse. It seems to be the kind of the half lives, so to speak, of all these crises seems to be getting shorter and shorter. We seem to be just ricocheting from one to another, and they all seem to be combining in a perfect storm, as they say. But this short-term thinking, which you mentioned in terms of you know, the path that you took in understanding climate change by, you know, immersing yourself in the scientific literature for several years, which obviously most of us are not able to do, either by inclination or time or whatever. But even just, you know, the basic, just even getting a basic framework of seeing that it is a problem, seeing sort of basically what the basic outline of the problem is. That's something that, you know, really anybody, you know, with a modicum of time and coherent thinking is able to do. But, you know, that goes against the classic short-term profit-oriented thinking. It's basically this, you know, that's I think what we really don't get, that how deeply embedded in us that mm-hmm. that cycle, you know, of you know what we used to call deep ecology, when, you know, I got involved in Earth First, as counterposed to, you know, shallow ecology, which is sort of embodied by the NGOs that you're talking about, a very, you know, pragmatic, opportunistic sort of basically playing along with the structures, economic, political, institutional, as they're constituted, rather than actually seeing, again, you know, reality, the ecological reality, you know, the deeper psychological, cultural realities, whatever it might be. And, you know, those, the clash between those, the need to develop, you know, to have the time and space to be able to develop an understanding of what's really going on versus the demands of this, you know, this insane system, which has us all in its thrall, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. And of course, you're talking there about our form of capitalism we have today, which is neoliberalism. And I might just reference people, an article I wrote about this called Eco-Economics Takes on Neoliberalism, April 20th of this year. It's in Counterpunch, but that's Eco-Economics Takes on Neoliberalism, which explains a lot of things that I think that people who really care about where we're headed and what this capitalistic system we've got, I think it explains that fairly well in the context of what should be done, which is eco-economics. The neoliberal economic system that we've got has joined hands with a transnationalist capitalist class that works beyond borders of state nation states. In other words, they all have allegiance to each other now. They all meet at the same forums. There are several of these there every year, like the World Economic Forum held in Davos, Switzerland every year. They are the elite. This is the 1% that's been identified over the last few years as problematic for all the rest of us in the world. And they've become their own political force, and they're really literally dictating what's happening internally in nation states via a global structure. So that's what's happened. And the neoliberalism part of the capitalistic structure, or that brand of it, which Milton Friedman really brought to fruition in the early 50s. And then it was put into turbocharged gear by both Reagan and Thatcher at the same time. What it really means is that we're going to privatize everything. We take everything out of the public domain and put it into the private domain because it's more profitable in the private domain and we can watch it better and profit by it more. For example, you had, and let's give me also talk a little bit about people pushing back, because one of the things that you brought to my attention, Paul, before we had this interview today, is I went back and referenced the People's Agreement of Chocobamba in Bolivia in 2010. And that's when the undeveloped countries of the world came together and talked about the complicity of developed countries with the scientific community. But Chocobamba is an interesting city because that's the city that fought back. That's the city where they privatized their water and they priced the whole community out of the market. People couldn't afford the installations. They couldn't afford the water. And it's the big French company. What's the name of the big French worldwide company that's the water company? Can you think of a? It's Suez.
Suez. Oh, you mean Nestle?
Well, no.
Or Evian? Evian?
The one in France. Huh?
Evian?
Whatever. Yeah.
Anyway.
I think it's called Suez Water. Anyway, they're a global water company.
Uh-huh.
What happened? People should go to YouTube and pull up some articles, some videos about this, because the videos take you onto the streets and show you the people fighting back and the people who were shot and killed because the people hit the streets because they couldn't afford water anymore. Well, eventually, they beat them. They got them out. They moved them out of Bolivia, this private water company out of France. But these are the kind of battles that are rare, but it sends a powerful message about what neoliberalism is all about.
And we, of course, have a battle, similar battle here in Oregon with the fighting against Nestle and the people who have putting a ballot initiative to ban all commercial water bottling in Hood River County have just handed in their signatures. So that's interesting. There are also similar battles, I'm sure you know them, in California against both Nestle and also Crystal Geyser up north in Mount Shasta. And that's a emerging battlefield all around the planet. But yeah, that was a major... I followed that when it was happening. That was really huge, what you're talking about. But we do have a caller. I'm talking with Robert Hunsaker. The number to call is 503-231-8187. We're talking about a whole bunch of different things, reckoning with reality. Let's go to our first caller. Esteban, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning, Paul and Robert. Thank you for being here and bringing this subject up. This is just an observation of mine, and I've wondered if you could comment, verify the validity, that the power plant that has gone haywire over there in Japan was constructed and manufactured by General Electric, one of our largest profiteers from war making. And the CEO, I think currently still, or at the time he took office, the CEO of General Electric has been Jeffrey Immelt, who has been Obama's Secretary of Energy for some time and still is, to my knowledge. Could you verify any of that? I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
No, the current Secretary of Energy, he's not the current Secretary of Energy, and I don't think he was ever Secretary of Energy. He may have been Secretary of Commerce for a while. But yeah, he did work for I think he was with the Obama administration for a while. Do you recall, Paul?
No, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But General Electric.
The Secretary of Energy is an MIT gentleman, his last name Moniz, M-O-N-I-Z.
Yeah, I just thought that there might be a connection in keeping this on the lowdown as far as any future construction of GE power plants.
Well, you know what? It's interesting you bring this up because... China, for example, has on the drawing board right now 400 new nuclear plants.
Oh, sure.
Can you imagine that?
Yeah. Sure. No, they're still safe as far as those people are concerned.
I thought China was going green.
Oh, they're doing that as well, but they're so overwhelmed with this. I mean, right now, they just shut down in Beijing. They shut down all traffic into Beijing. They shut down the schools in Beijing. You know why? Too much pollution. People can't breathe in the city right now. As you and I speak on the phone today, people are wearing masks, and very few people are in the streets, and very few cars are in the streets in Beijing. They have a momentous, unbelievable problem with air pollution and that type of thing. So, but they're taking on, they are going very green. In fact, China is outspending. They spent $80 billion in green technology last year. They outspent the United States and the EU combined. They've got the message. They understand the problem, and they're trying to address it. But you can only move so fast, and they're going in every direction, including nukes. They have been shutting down coal-fired plants, by the way, which is really a great relief, because what's happened is if you look at the emissions of CO2 into the atmosphere, if you look at a chart of that going back the last 40 years or so, when it starts to take off and accelerate is in the 80s and 90s. Well, that's when China discovered capitalism and said, gee, we're going to move all these peasants off the farms, the poor peasants who are working in the rice fields, and move them into these metropolitan areas where we're going to build big cities, big factories, and have them work there, and they'll make more money and become some kind of a middle class. And I think they've had, I'd say, in my view, lame results in that regard, except for the privileged class. And again, we're back to the transnational elite capitalist. And boy, they have more billionaires in the Chinese Communist Party than we do in our U.S. Congress.
Well, you know, I want to get to something you said earlier, which is you talked about, you know, conference in Bolivia and the fight against the water privatization. You mentioned, you know, that the people who got together in Bolivia were the undeveloped countries. I just want to sort of push back on that, because I think that's, again, one of those sort of under-examined concepts, you know, the idea of development and undevelopment or underdevelopment or whatever. You know, I mean, that in a way, what China's doing is sort of like, that's sort of the idea of universal progress, you know, that will lead to, you know, that will ultimately solve all our problems, which is if, you know, everybody follows sort of the capitalist growth-oriented developmental model, but it's actually showing itself to be just a further extension and maybe the final conclusion of this nightmare that was unleashed by this massive technological development. And so I just, you know, I think we should be wary of using these terms of developed and undeveloped. What does that actually really mean?
You're right. And then this is the greatest oxymoron of them all, which is green growth. Now here's an interesting thing, Paul, that dovetails with everything we're saying. If you look at the average person in industrialized countries and what it requires for them to sustain their material consumption, so that'd be Eastern Europe, I mean, all of Europe and the United States and other industrialized countries, not the developing countries. The World Resources Institute did a detailed study of this, and it takes 5 to 12 acres of productive land, and if you take a midpoint, 7 to 8 acres, let's say 8 acres of productive land, to support the average person in industrialized countries, okay? And that's based upon resource flows contained in goods and services. However, and here's the catch, there's only 3.5 or 3.5 acres per capita of ecologically productive land on the entire planet. So what you've got is you have less than 20% of the world's population is consuming all of the ecologically productive land, 100%. And that explains a lot about why in the world you have 2 billion people making $2 per day for a living. There's no room. We're over-consuming. The capitalistic system we've got where you have glory buying, glory purchasing. I can have a 2,500-foot house. The guy next to me has to have a 3,000-foot, and eventually you get someone with a 20,000-square-foot house. Glory purchasing. So there are some kind of bright people out there who said, there's a way to tackle all of this if we could get people organized. And there are people like Sir Richard Hicks, the British economist, who talked about natural income, natural capital. Because what we've got in our capitalistic system today is two types of capital. You've got labor capital and human-made capital, and they leave nature capital out of the equation. And I encourage people to go out and study eco-economics, because what we need to do, in that we can't really beat the current neoliberal capital system. We can't beat it. It's got too strong of a hold over the entire world through the World Bank, through the IMF, through all these different big international resources. We somehow have to modify it, and you have to modify it to the extent that they have to recognize natural capital and natural income. A forest is natural capital. The trees are the sustainable harvest. And what Sir Richard Hicks, the British economist who helped develop eco-economics, said was that the natural income is that level of consumption that you can sustain from one period to the next without reducing your natural wealth. So it goes against the scorched earth policy of corporations today who are only searching for profit, and they could care less about ecology.
Well, let me just stop you right there, and again invite callers. Seems to be a quiet day here. 503-231-8187 is the number. Before I respond, I just want to say, coming up this morning on KABU at 9 on Political Perspectives, host Doug McVeigh interviews writer, teacher, and filmmaker Lisa Raine about Aaron Swartz, Edward Snowden, digital privacy, and electronic freedom. And once again, thank all of you KABU members for your support in our recent membership drive. And it's never too late to become a member or increase your current membership and have it doubled. Just go to kboo.fm and click on Donate today. So I think you and I might actually have a serious disagreement here, which I think is worth exploring. And it's something that I've explored in other interviews, specifically with Corey Morningstar. And I think she takes serious issue with this idea that we, have to modify rather than overthrow the neoliberal capitalist system. And so I think it's potentially true that also Naomi Klein and Bill McKibben, 350.org, also feel that way. And that sort of colors the approach that they're taking to this, the issue of climate change. You know, it seems like the idea of, you know, a revolutionary struggle, or however one wants to, you know, whatever idea, metaphor, whatever one wants to use, seems to be, I don't know, there just seems to be a general sense of sort of fatalism that, you know, we can't actually seriously revolutionize the systems of power that we live in. We have to somehow modify them.
Yeah, and I know where you're coming from, but what I'm talking about, Paul, is a really pure pragmatism, and on a pragmatic basis, it just seems to me in my head that I don't know how you can revolutionize the system. I don't know that it can happen. Certainly in our lifetime, I think a lot of seeds can get planted, but how can you overcome the grip that the neoliberal transnational class of elite has over the entire planet. It just is getting more powerful, more profit-oriented, more commodifying everything-oriented all the time. When we started shipping our entire middle-class wages in the 80s and 90s offshoring product to countries like China, where people were getting paid $1 or $2 a day, or maybe $1 an hour, whatever it is now, it's crazy still. I'm getting a little bit far off stream here, but I think and I'm a pragmatist in this regard, I think you somehow have to try to modify the system. I don't know if you can beat it, is what I'm trying to say.
Well, I guess I would say that I think the way things are going, in my view, it's those are perhaps equally illusionary approaches to the situation. I don't see how it can be modified to the extent that you're talking about to stave off the the looming massive change in our biosphere that due to what you've written about methane releases. You know, it seems like the inability of the system to deal with existing crises, let alone forestall the accumulating crises, seems to be basically there doesn't seem to be a place within it that there doesn't seem to be any of the elites that are except for maybe this guy who writes about eco-economics, whatever his name is you just mentioned, you know, maybe some of the I forget the guy who did all those public television programs on nature. You know, it seems like there are people like that who come out of the elite. Yeah, there are some of them, it's true. But they seem to be like the outliers. It seems like, you know, I just listened to an interview with Ted Koppel, who has a book called Lights Out, which is about the danger of a catastrophic cyber attack on our grid system. You know, and this is sort of different but related to what we're talking about, which are basically catastrophic disruptions of our civilized way of life due to whatever. And he says there's basically no large-scale planning for a major disruption of the grid. It just doesn't exist.
I know.
You know, there's no plan. There's just no plan to deal with what's happening. The plan seems to be only more of the same. You know, there came out the Homeland Security, the Pentagon's reports on climate change, the, you know, plans for corralling dissent in the case of large scale, you know, civic unrest due to whatever, climate change or whatever. It seems to be the only approach is to continued militarization and control, because that's the only logic they know.
Well, that's exactly what's happening. You're right on the money there. I mean, the federal government has sent military hardware to police departments all across the country. You know, you got to ask yourself, why would they do that? Well, they want to keep the streets people off the streets, and they want to prevent any kind of massive demonstrations by the people in the country, I guess. Why else would you do it? Why do you need military hardware in police departments around the country? And this is hundreds of millions of dollars worth of this stuff. So what we've really got, and it's very difficult sometimes to see on a given day where you really are in the cycle. But where we are in the cycle, and when history looks back, is we're in a police state cycle, period. Not only here, it's worldwide. And so what's happened is, I hate to sound conspiratorial about it, but there is a very tiny elite of people who all know each other in the world, who basically are pulling the strings one way or another, and they're controlling what's happening in our lives. And that's reinforced by the police state. And it's 1984. If someone listening to this show hasn't read it, they ought to pick up the book and read it, because we're living it.
You know, let me just interrupt you, because we do have a couple callers. Barth, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. Great talk. Thank you, Mr. Hunziker. This is a wide-ranging discussion that I think needs more airtime. Your mention of, I'm going to amuse myself and say eco-economics, I think that the change of bringing that kind of thinking on into the main discussion, the changing of systems to reflect the natural capital and its place in the world, the idea of the value of production of monetary exchange by people doing fishing trips instead of logging the forests locally, for example, the revisiting the idea of GPA and what it represents, where it's not, you know, plane crashes and auto accidents and blowing up buildings to raise the GPA, that it has more in line of actually improving life versus just measuring numbers. Those are the kinds of things that are already being discussed, and those are the kinds of things that may allow some shifting in the capitalist model versus, you know, tearing it down and starting over, which, you know, everybody likes, not everybody, but people like that as an idea and as an abstract, but making the society function in a totally revolutionary way where, you know, all that you know is wrong and we have to rewrite the book, I don't know that we can do those, both of those things at the same time. And Paul, you might argue that we have to do...
Well, my argument is we have to start with ourselves. We should forget everybody else for just a second and just work on ourselves first. Like, revolutionize our own thinking and see where that takes us, you know? I think that's the fundamental step.
I would agree with that. And the recently departed... music and activist that you played in the intro of the show was all about that, about changing the way you think and about freeing your mind from the constraints of structured thought and shaped reality that you just have to step into versus walking through. One other thought, that the military equipment for cops reflects the energy of the small minority at the top, and also reinforces the truth, not just the abstract, but the truth, that the U.S. is the largest military and arms supplier ever in history, and that is the wave that we're putting out across the world, and that many of the huge conflicts, that not only the ones that we have deliberately started, but the other ones that are ongoing, are reinforced and flamed back into blazing intensity by efforts of our government and the military-industrial complex to keep those things going.
All right, listen, we got another call, so thank you, Barth.
Good,
and
I'll fair enough.
Go ahead, Robert.
Let me insert something very quickly here before I forget. I want to recommend to everybody that they pick up Andre Vilcek's, it's spelled V-L-T-C-H-E-K, Andre Vilcek's book, Lies of the Empire. It's an 800-page documentary about him traveling around. He's the war foreign correspondent. He and Noam Chomsky are very close, and they've done work together. He's probably our greatest leftist in the world today as an intellectual leftist, Andre Vilcek, Lies of the Empire. Pick up that book and read it. It's fascinating, and it goes right to the heart of what this last gentleman was just talking about. I'm a third of the way through the book, and it's a page-turner. You cannot set it down. Lies of the Empire by Andre Vilcek, V-L-T-C-H-E-K.
Well, since you're mentioning books, we did have a listener, Camilo, called to say that this book covers everything we're talking about. Disposable Futures, The Seduction of Violence in the Age of Spectacle by Brad Evans and Henry Giroux. I know Giroux has also contributed to Counterpunch. There's another thing for your reading list, Disposable Futures, The Seduction of Violence in the Age of Spectacle. But we have Sean also on the line waiting to talk. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, another quick book, and I've mentioned it to you before, Paul, and that's Mario Vargas Llosa's Wellsprings. But beyond that, I just wanted to add to this whole idea of what revolution and revolutionizing means, and it takes on so many terms, and ways of doing it. And I just wanted to say, I agree with you, Paul, it's all about starting with ourselves. I mean, ultimately, everything does start and actually end there. And so I think, to me, that the way that Bill McKibben and Naomi Klein and so forth are saying about more modifying, trying to modify the system than trying to overthrow it in a revolutionary way, is that very thing of just take responsibility for the way that you live your life, the choices that you make, and modify it that way. I don't see them really stating it in any other way, because we found that over and over, political revolutions don't ultimately get people what they want. It just ends up getting them more of the very thing that they don't want.
Well, I didn't mention really anything about political revolution myself. I'm not sure who you're taking issue with that.
Well, I'm not really taking issue with anybody or anything about it. I'm just stating my opinion about it. And I think the most current example of how political revolutions don't work is Arab Spring. It just ended up eventually getting them more of the very thing that they didn't want. French Revolution and so forth. Ultimately, true revolution, if people want the change that they want, they have to work at the very things that they do, and the choices that they make will force the changes that they want. And on the other side of that whole revolution is, you know, when you look at the neoliberal politics and the kind of global capitalism that's happening, is the very, you know, Friedman's politics and economics have spread globally. That's what this is all about.
Okay.
You're not going to do a revolutionary thing to change all that. Just like you're not going to revolutionize the arms industry, the United States, which is the largest arms dealer in the world. You know, the way you do that is by making choices to not be violent,
okay,
to not support arms and so forth. You know, so the way you change the whole system, because they're bringing down the very system that they want. The people that want this very thing in terms of global capitalism are creating this kind of hell that we're talking about right now. So that's a revolution unto itself.
Okay, we got to run. We're almost out of time.
Yep.
Thank you so much for calling. I kind of disagree with what you're saying. I personally would encourage people to read the much smaller book called To Our Friends by the Invisible Committee. Some people were asking about it. I read from it last week. To Our Friends, the Invisible Committee. You can pick a copy of that up at the Anaris Info Shop, which is up on North Lombard, the 7,000, so I think it's 70, around 7,200, just past the Fred Meyers. Anyway, they've got copies of this. Also, this booklet, Desert, I think that will be available up there as well. I think those are really good places, which talk more about an insurrectionary approach, which is sort of in between the individual and sort of the idea of mass revolutionary organizing, which happened in the Sousa Valley 10 years ago yesterday, which I had meant to talk more about, in the effort to stop a high-speed train project, and succeeded for 5 years anyway, and they're still undergoing a small-scale sort of civic guerrilla warfare, low-intensity war against that project. But I'd recommend people go look up the history of the NOTAV, N-O-T-A-V. That's an Italian acronym for high-speed train. Anyway, we're about out of time. I'll just give you the last word to respond to what the last caller was talking about, Robert.
I would say this, that I agree with his final statement. And I'll kind of paraphrase it. I can't remember exactly how he said it, but I really liked it when he said that When it comes to revolutionary matters, the capitalist system is taking itself down. And that's an internal revolution that they're causing themselves. And I thought I'd like to go back and recapture his statement and write it down so I have it, because I really like the way he put that. But in point of fact, there is a revolution taking place. When he said that, this really struck me. And it's capitalism is stepping on its own foot. And you go back and read Karl Marx and what he talked about 150 years ago is starting to happen today, and that is capitalism will cannibalize itself, and it's doing it because it's cannibalizing our entire ecosystem. Our ecosystem right now, as we speak, is subject to collapse, and when it comes, it's going to come hard and fast, and you're going to have, if they think that the migrant problem in Europe is a problem now, it's going to be a worldwide phenomenon. There's people in massive groups. Go see the movie. If no one saw the movie Mad Max, that's where we're headed.
Okay, we got to run, Robert. So that's the last word, Mad Max. And thank you so much, Robert Hunsaker from Los Angeles. This is Paul Rowland, and this has been Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio.
Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. The time is 9 o'clock, and it's time for Political Perspectives coming up first this morning on KBOO with host Doug McVeigh. He interviews writer, teacher, and filmmaker Lisa Rhine about Aaron Schwartz, Aaron's Edward Snowden, digital privacy, and electronic freedom. And then at 10 o'clock, we've got Chris Andre hosting Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, Doctors Without Borders calls for an international war crimes investigation into the U.S.-NATO bombing of a hospital in Afghanistan. At 11 o'clock on The Dirtbag, host Glenn Andreessen talks bees and beekeeping with Bill Catherall and Tim Wessels. It's the